Welcome to another T-Rex talk on the three worst gun control ideas, which is an extremely clickbaity title. And I'm not even going to tell you what exactly I mean by worst until the end of the episode. So if you want to know what I mean by worst, you got to listen to the whole thing or skip ahead. One of the two. But the three worst gun control ideas that I'm going to talk about today are smart guns, ghost guns, and micro stamping. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about some other things and what I mean by worst. So, you know, stay tuned for that. But as we talk about gun control, there's a bunch of different strategies that people go about to try to curtail gun violence or legal gun ownership or both. It's usually both. And all of these different tactics have certain strengths or weaknesses depending on what the actual goals are. So let's talk about smart guns for a moment. So in 2002, New Jersey, which already had really bad gun laws, passed a new law called the Child-Proof Handgun Law. And first of all, this is a really bad name because it doesn't actually follow that a smart gun is going to be child-proof. But anyway, that's what they call the law because that's a great way to get the law passed, to make guns child-proof. So the idea of a smart gun that recognizes its owner so that it can only be fired by an authorized user seems like a pretty good idea, but the main purpose of this bill is not actually to promote the adoption of smart guns, but it is to eliminate all other non-smart guns. So the law specifically states that as soon as a smart gun is available on the commercial market in retail establishments, 3 years after the first one has been sold, no other traditional firearms can be sold in the state of New Jersey. That was a law that was passed in 2002. The goal, again, being not to promote smart gun sales, but to eliminate all other gun sales. And this is a bad idea for a whole bunch of reasons that are probably really obvious. So guns are tools, right, Samuel?
Yeah.
Yeah, what are guns used for? What
battle.
Are they? Battle? Yeah. That's like a last ditch life or death scenario. That's when you really need to use firearms as a tool. And so if you have a smart gun that requires that you have to type in a code or you have to wear an RFID watch or bracelet or ring and you have to wait for the fingerprint reader to process, all that stuff takes time, even in a best case scenario when everything is working properly. And then in the worst case scenario, stuff isn't working properly. Your RFID bracelet thing has a dead battery or the gun itself has a dead battery or some of the pieces have been broken or there's an electrical failure or your hands are bloody so the fingerprint reader doesn't work.
Got it.
Well, maybe that would happen, but yeah, like right now, what do I have on my finger right here?
Kind of blood.
Yeah, I got a lot of little cuts on my left forefinger from working on razor sharp aluminum that I was putting into the CNC machine. So there's no fingerprint on that finger to be read right now. Now it's gonna heal. It would not work.
God will heal it.
Who will heal my finger?
God.
Yeah, but right now a machine could not read my fingerprint properly. A fingerprint reader would not work. If I were wounded in some other way and I had blood on my hands, fingerprint reader would not work. And so, obviously, guns should have safety features, and yet they need to fail gracefully. And the question is, should the gun fail in a way that makes it easier to fire or makes it harder to fire? And in the situations where you really need a firearm, you don't want that firearm to fail in a way that makes it impossible to fire. But even if the technology were perfect and it never broke and the batteries never ran out and it was always instantaneously, perfectly, magically flawless all the time, there's still scenarios where it isn't ideal. What if I need to pass the gun to my wife? What if I want to loan the gun to a friend? What if I want to take somebody to the range? I need to be able to disable the safety features so they can try it out to see if it's a gun that they want to purchase. And what is the cost going to be of adding this magical, foolproof, totally unkillable electronic technology to my gun? I'd like to point out that gun companies specialize in and excel at manufacturing mechanical engineering. They generally don't have a whole lot of advanced computer engineers on staff to build this magical tech module. And then what exactly is that tech module going to have to do? Because the goalposts could potentially keep moving. If you are a small arms manufacturer and you don't have this on staff, you're going to outsource it. You're going to buy somebody else's third-party module. And the authorization mechanism that has to be held to some sort of specific specification, you're going to outsource that to some sort of cloud services provider, something like Facebook login, because they provide the OAuth certification with two-factor, blah, blah, blah. That's going to be fine until they decide that smart guns actually violate their terms of service, and now your gun doesn't work. you release Smart Gun version 1, but then the legislation changes so that now you need to be able to remotely disable a firearm. In the same way that cars made after a certain year in the future, they also need the capability to be remotely disabled. That's actually a real law. Look it up. And then there's the fact that this electronic module has to be removable. So if a gun is stolen by somebody, it can't be used instantaneously, perhaps. But stolen guns are going to be taken to people that can remove these modules, so that gun is then again useful on the black market. So at the end of the day, even in its best case scenario, it still is only going to be helpful in a tiny percentage of incidents. So obviously, this is a really, really dumb idea. And again, its main purpose is not to promote smart guns, but to prevent companies that make traditional guns from being able to sell those in the not-too-distant future. And so, rather than stimulate smart gun development in any of the major gun companies, they realized that working on this technology at all would be shooting themselves literally in the foot, in the arm, and the head. And believe it or not, New Jersey actually changed the law in 2019 because it obviously wasn't doing what they wanted to do. So the new law merely requires that after there is a smart gun commercially available on the retail market and the state attorney general approves this production model and actually thinks that it's a solid product, each firearms retailer in the state would then be required to carry this firearm and to display it with, you know, the free advertising signage around it. They only have to stock one gun, but still not a great law, because just think about the cost of having to carry one potentially very expensive firearm and give it a space of prominence in your shop with free advertising around it. Not a very free market of them, but it is, after all, New Jersey. And this theoretically is the kind of law that would stimulate a company to develop a smart gun to get in on some of that free advertising. But the good news is it wouldn't actually squeeze any of the other firearm manufacturers out of the market or push them out of the stores. So, again, one of the worst gun control ideas in the past, so bad that even its proponents admitted that it was failing. Second one I want to talk about is micro-stamping. And micro-stamping, like smart guns, is a gun control measure that is on the books in one state. And of course, it's California. California passed a micro-stamping bill. This is Assembly Bill 1471. It was passed in 2007. It was signed by Arnold Schwarzenegger, and it was actually put on hold because what it was endeavoring to require is physically impossible. We'll get to that later. It wasn't actually put into effect until the year 2013, and that was, who was it? Who was the Attorney General at that time in California in 2013? Oh, it was Kamala Harris. That's right. And essentially what this bill does is it adds all guns that do not have micro stamping capabilities to the unsafe weapon list. In California, you are only allowed to sell safe weapons. You are not allowed to sell unsafe weapons. And of course, the police are exempt. They are allowed to purchase and to use unsafe weapons. So the only guns that can be sold to the general public are the not unsafe guns, which is, well, first of all, it's terrible grammar. But second of all, it's three things that are pretty bad. The first is a loaded chamber indicator, which is not terrible, but it's one piece that can break and it's not allowed to break. The second is a magazine disconnector, so that it's impossible to fire the gun when the magazine is not in it. I really hate magazine disconnectors. And the third one is micro stamping. And to describe micro-stamping, I'm going to actually read the actual text of the law. Hopefully that helps. It requires a microscopic array of characters that identify the make, model, and serial number of the pistol, etched or otherwise imprinted on two or more places on the interior surface or internal working parts of the pistol that are transferred by imprinting on each cartridge case when the firearm is fired. So that's the legal language. What it requires is that there be two things that stamp a serial number into each cartridge case that is ejected. So basically, firing pin and extractor is the way that this is supposed to work. So the firing pin hits the primer and stamps a serial number at least 25 microns deep into the primer. And then the extractor, when it ejects that cartridge, also stamps that same serial number, at least 25 microns deep, into the side of the brass, so that there's two serial numbers on every piece of brass that runs through the gun. Now, the problem with this is, of course, physics. Picture a firing pin at this moment in your head. In a pistol, a firing pin is a very small diameter rod that strikes that primer. You got to be able to engrave the serial number onto the head of that firing pin with microscopic numbers and letters. So when it strikes the primer, it leaves that number behind. And 25 microns deep, that is half the diameter of a human hair. That is nothing. That is less than 1/1000th of an inch. Those teeny tiny numbers on the head of that firing pin, which is a little bit bigger than the head of a regular pin, but not a whole lot, those numbers instantly wear out, and they are super easy to remove. If you think about the forces inside of the gun, the case pressure as you're firing it, the fact that the primer is exploding as soon as the firing pin hits it, if you think about all of the corrosion and carbon and gunk that gets on there and would get inside of the little teeny tiny letters of these microscopic engravings, yeah, they don't last super long. And even in the best case laboratory testing scenarios with completely pristine, unused gun parts, you need an electron microscope to read these things. And you need to be able to scan at least 10 empty shell casings before you can actually read the entire number. So, practically speaking, physically speaking, this is impossible. The requirement that is laid out by the law is not something that can be done in the physical world with the technology that we currently have or are going to have anytime in the near future. Also, I should note that this technology is proprietary. It's owned and patented by a company called TAC Labs. That's the only company that this technology can be purchased from. So that's another hurdle. This law that requires the impossible also requires that you buy impossible tech from a single entity. So a lot of times when you see this in laws, it is the result of some kind of monopolistic corporate cronyism where somebody invents a thing and then they hire lobbyists to go out and force everybody that wants to be in a certain market to buy from them and only from them because hiring lobbyists is cheaper than hiring marketers. But I don't think that's actually the case here. I think that the desire of the guy who invented this technology is actual gun control because he has expressed a desire that this patent would expire so that it could become public domain so that everybody could use it. And the purpose of this law appears to be exactly the same as the smart gun law. It isn't so much to actually make sure that all of the guns that are made in the future have the capability to microstamp, but to get rid of all of the guns that currently do not microstamp. Now, I don't fully understand exactly how this law is applied, but the gun owners of California have reported that there were 967 models available for lawful purchase when the roster was certified less than a decade ago, and today there are under 250 available models. And the reason that I think that that is because models like the original XD or the original Glock Generation 3, those are still available to purchase because they were for sale prior to this law being passed. And then guns like the XD2, the XDM, the Glock Gen 3, later revisions of guns and models of guns cannot be sold in California because they do not have this microstamping technology. And there are some guns. For all of Springfield's faults, the fact that they keep that original XD around simply so that people in California can buy it is, I think, an excellent move. But this law is hugely problematic. And it's been challenged a couple of times, and a California court actually overruled one of the challenges because they said, I don't have the quote here, but it's kind of an amazing quote. It says, being unable to achieve the impossible is an excuse for noncompliance, but it is not a reason to overturn the statute or get rid of the law, which I think is absolutely preposterous. If the court is willing to acknowledge that this technology is physically impossible, that is a fantastic reason to overturn the statute. And then, if magical technology comes along in the future, we can revisit that. But by criminalizing people who have failed to achieve the impossible, that's terrible. That's terrible precedent. Now, I will say that this idea of putting the serial number on the ejected brass, that is theoretically more useful than just having a serialized gun. As long as that serial number actually connects to the criminal, which it usually doesn't. The easiest way to make the serial number correspond to the criminal is to change the gun laws so that the original lawful owner of the buyer is now a criminal. Bingo, perfect. Now you have actually achieved the goal. Now, This brings us to the topic of serialization in general. And one thing that we need is we need somebody to do a really deep dive study into how often serial numbers are actually used to solve crimes or convict murderers. Most of the time that you see police departments or detectives or people talking about investigations and they go into the serial number of the gun and tracing the provenance of the gun, that usually is in pretty high profile cases like mass shooters where they already have the guy, they already have the guns. All the serial numbers are doing is making it just a little bit easier to figure out where he got them. So I have a challenge for somebody or multiple people who are listening to this podcast right now. If you would like to take on this interesting research project of how useful serial numbers on guns actually are for solving crimes or convicting people that have committed actual crimes of murder, get in touch with me. Get in touch with the CS team, team@trex-arms.com. We will turn this into a YouTube video. If we can get together good research, we'll cover that. Because that is something that really needs to be covered because serialized and unserialized guns, that's a major, major talking point because of bad gun control strategy number three, ghost guns. So this whole war that we're currently seeing against ghost guns is predicated on this idea that an unserialized gun is far, far more dangerous than a serialized gun, that it's very hard to use a serialized gun to commit a crime, and it's super easy for an unserialized gun to be used in the commission of a crime. There's a new ATF rule that we talked about in a previous episode, banning 80% lowers because ghost guns are an increasing problem. Now, the reason that ghost guns are an increasing problem is because the term a ghost gun is an increasingly wide term. That net is being cast wider and wider so that it now includes all unserialized guns. That includes homemade guns, yes, but it also includes guns that were made before serialization was required, and it also includes guns that have had the serial numbers ground off, which is not that difficult. The serial numbers on a firearm that comply with ATF engraving rules has to be 3/1000ths of an inch deep. So that is way deeper than the micro stamping requirements, but it still is not that hard to Dremel off. Now, it should be noted that the stamping process that is used by a lot of gun manufacturers actually affects the metal of the frame, if it is a metal-framed gun, far deeper than that 3/1000ths of an inch engraving or stamping. And so, if you use really super fancy laboratory technology, you can often reveal the stresses in the grains of the steel deep underneath where that serial number is. But this is a really complicated, convoluted, expensive process, and I don't think it gets used in a whole bunch of unsolved Chicago mysteries. In the same way that micro stamping requires access to an electron microscope, revealing ground-off serial numbers is technically possible in a number of instances, but it requires access to laboratory technology that isn't really a part of normal police investigation procedures. So it's actually really easy to get rid of that serial number. So because the term ghost gun now includes all of these instances, we're banning 80% lowers. And I actually feel like this persecution of 80% lower companies is kind of pointless. Seeing how fast 3D printers have grown in their maturity, how quickly and easy and powerful they are now, how simple it is to actually print the plastic frame of a handgun on a $200 3D printer that you can buy from Amazon right now today, link in the description below. Squashing those few businesses that were making 80% lowers and jigs is deeply unjust and incredibly unfair to those businesses that will potentially be going bankrupt, but it doesn't actually stop people making plastic pistol frames at home, which means that a ban on home manufacturing of firearms can only be enforced by banning parts, tools, information, plans, etc. And this is something that we've talked about for a while. There's another YouTube video that I'll link to in the description. We were talking about the government's desire to control 3D printed guns years ago, and the fact that it does require controlling all kinds of tools, all kinds of information, all kinds of different things that really cannot be controlled by governments at all. To stop people from doing this means that there need to be laws and rules that are made and enforced by people who don't understand engineering, don't understand manufacturing, design, technology, or tools, and they will cast a much wider net over the things that they are trying to control than even they're casting over the definition of ghost gun. It will be literally unenforceable, but in some ways I feel like that is kind of the point and kind of on purpose. Especially since today there is much more of an emphasis on controlling information in general. So As long as the Ministry of Truth or the Office of Disinformation or whatever it's called is going to be able to prevent you from making jokes about Supreme Court abortion rulings, yeah, they're going to be able to stop you from talking about firearms at all. So the control of gun information and what that means from a First Amendment perspective, that's kind of not on people's radar anymore because they are so significantly focused on the control of all information right now. But let's just take some of these gun control ideas at their face value. Let's take them in good faith. Let's assume that they are designed to control only those things that they put on the marketing campaign. Let's presume that there's going to be no ulterior motives or over-policing or changing of the goalposts at all. These restrictions still have a massive effect on a pretty large industry of law-abiding American citizens and their customers. And this is something that we've talked a little bit about in the past, but the firearm industry, even the small arm industry, actually has a huge influence on the development of technology, new materials, new manufacturing techniques. To stifle this industry is to really put a significant limit on a lot of the research and development that is extremely important for a nation's GDP or the future of its civilization. Now, I believe that the small arms industry is uniquely suited to guarantee the future of a nation's civilization. But even if we just look at the pure mechanical engineering side, small arms development has really driven a whole bunch of manufacturing techniques that have been extremely important for the industrial capabilities of the United States. And to go out of your way to really limit the research, the development, the propagation, the decentralization and ability of people to start businesses doing these things and to develop techniques that will transfer over to other industries and increase the manufacturing strength and wealth of a nation is incredibly counterproductive. And again, if we assume that that's all that it's going to do and nothing else. Clearly, that's a pretty dumb assumption. There is a lot of ulterior motive stuff going on, and an excellent example of that actually popped up yesterday on May 5th in California again. California Bill AB 1227 started its life as something in the building code. It opened up Section 25402, which is, of course, as we all know, relating to building codes and energy. This was a bill that had to do with roof replacement, something inside of building standards and solar. But yesterday, on May 5th, it was completely changed by an amendment. It is now opening up Section 36001, which has to do with firearms and has to do with taxes. This bill has completely changed to a excise tax, 10 or 11% on all guns, gun parts, ammunition, etc. So not only do we have this weird bait and switch where the bill starts out as being an innocuous building code thing, now it switches over to a tax bill. But even inside of the bill itself, it's not pretending to be a revenue bill. It says that this bill will specifically address the gun violence public health crisis. This kind of bait and switch, this kind of disingenuous, this kind of really bad faith argumentation is pretty emblematic of what these gun control arguments always turn into. And so when I say that these are some of the worst gun control ideas, I don't actually even mean that they're the most effective. After all, the smart gun legislation in New Jersey failed to the point that it was actually changed by gun control advocates. The micro-stamping bill in California has put a crimp on the sale of certain firearms in California, but it hasn't actually had the desired effect. And I'm going to predict that the ghost gun focus is actually going to do far more to promote the possibility that you can make guns at home easily than it will actually stop people from buying 80% lower kits. So in some ways, these are the worst ideas for actually pursuing that good faith goal, which I'm throwing out there as a ridiculous presupposition on its face. But I do think it's worth pointing out that some gun control proponents actually do think that guns cause gun violence, and these are dumb but good faith ideas in those folks' mind. The problem is that there's actually a huge percentage of people that want a disarmed populace, and they don't care what the cost is in gun violence or in human lives. And so there's a bunch of other gun control ideas that we can talk about at a later date that are much, much worse, both from a functional perspective and an end goal perspective, but also in a presuppositional perspective. What the authors of these bills, what the proponents of these ideas are actually trying to do is far darker and more sinister. And we can talk about that in a future episode, but I will give you a heads up on what some of those ideas would be. As we talk about all the different gun control ideas, buybacks, different storage requirements, centralized club stores so you can't actually keep the gun that you own in your own house, ammo registration, straight door-to-door confiscation, all of these ideas are going to appeal to different people based on what it is that they are actually trying to accomplish with their gun control. But let me throw out something that is relatively unpopular, but gaining steam. It actually is being kicked around in one of the states of Australia, and it's been kicked around in California, of course, no surprise there. This idea of a public database of gun owners. Now, remember, some of these gun control advocates are these same folks that demand that gun owners have really expensive, complicated, overbearing storage requirements and safes and locks and security systems in their homes because stolen guns are primarily used for crimes, and so guns being stolen is something that should be avoided at all costs, especially when the gun owner himself pays the cost. These same folks are now oftentimes recommending that there should be a public database of gun owners. If somebody is a gun owner, their address should be searchable on the web, just like, say, a sex offender. Because being a gun owner is basically the same thing. It makes you a person that should be called out, that should be marked, that should be avoided, that should be distrusted. Even though, obviously, a sex offender is somebody who has committed and been convicted of a crime, and a gun owner is usually, especially in Australia or in California, the kind of person who has gone above and beyond and jumped through far, far more hoops than almost any other kind of person in the country to be legal and above board. But this idea of creating a public database so that these folks can be shamed and inconvenienced and their life made more difficult is really being thrown out there as an excellent idea, even though, of course, the obvious result of making gun owners' home addresses publicly available and searchable is that a whole bunch of their guns are going to be stolen, a whole bunch of those guns are going to get out on the street, a whole bunch of those guns are going to be used to commit gun violence and actually hurt and kill people. And again, there are certain gun control advocates who would say that this is exactly the kind of thing that they're trying to avoid. And if they thought through and understood the ramifications of some of these bills, they would be opposed to them. But that other group of gun control advocates that just want that disarmed populace at whatever the cost, this is a fantastic idea because it will cause exactly the kind of furor and exactly the kind of pain and misery that will enable them to pass even harsher regulations in the future. So, getting back to the three that we talked about, the smart guns, the microstamping, the ghost guns, these particular gun control ideas don't actually create the kind of suffering that allows for raised tensions and extreme bills. These kind of bills are actually the little chipping away at the corners bills. They have massive ramifications, to be sure, but they don't actually generate the kind of press and the kind of blood and the kind of coverage that would actually allow for, a really solid pitch for the serious gun control stuff, the buybacks, the ammo registration, the confiscation, and so on. So in a future episode, we're going to talk about some of those more extreme ones, but I hope that you enjoyed is probably the wrong word. Hopefully it was informative to talk through some of the talking points for and against these different ideas, which I'm sure will pop up as there continues to be a ever-growing number of gun owners in the United States. And there is massive, massive pushback against gun control. And states are adopting constitutional carry willy-nilly and passing greater gun freedom in, not all the states, but a lot of the states that are not California and not New Jersey. I think we're going to see gun control advocates split into two camps. Those who look at the rising gun ownership completely misjudge what it means, or secretly understand exactly what it means and demand total disarmament before things get out of hand. And those who look at that and say, well, obviously we need a kinder, gentler, more accommodating way to prevent gun violence. And we're going to see more conversation about smart guns and micro stamping and people owning guns, but not being allowed to make them at home. These small concessions that nibble away at the edges, I think, are going to come back. Even in these midterm elections, you're going to see Democratic candidates take either the hard stance because of what MAGA country is beginning to look like, or they're going to take this accommodating stance where they understand that we live in a new world where people really really take gun rights seriously, and we're just going to have some of these new technological barriers that exist. Not barriers for you, but only barriers for crime. So be aware. I think it's going to be fascinating to watch this topic come up in the midterms, because a lot of Democrats are not going to want to bring this topic up. Too many votes attached to it. But it's one of these main talking points from the White House, so it's going to come up, and it's going to be really interesting to see what happens. So enjoy watching that chaos unfold, and start researching 3D printers, something that's absolutely going to pay off for you in the future, one way or another.